state testing test.
This is the Pittsburgh section of the National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. This is Linda Hurwitz and Priscilla Fidel interviewing Dr. Aaron Kessler on March 9, 1982. Dr. Kessler, I'd like to start off by asking you if you'd mind discussing with us some of the background of your family, the place of your birth, the background of your father and your mother and your sisters and your brothers.
My parents were born in Russia and migrated to Lithuania, which was the Jewish Pale of Settlement. I have a genealogy, what I call a genealogy of tradition in our family, which I prepared for my granddaughter's bat mitzvah. And I was able to trace accurately 10 generations.
That's incredible.
There's a very good possibility I could go back probably to 20, but I have not ascertained the accuracy of the other 10. On my mother's side, each generation of the 10 had one of the leading rabbis and scholars in Russia. Her father was a rabbi in Lithuania. He moved from Russia to Lithuania. And he was the author of 60 books in various fields, from commentary on the Bible to commentary on Maimonides to poetry to finally what we call a response to literature. On my father's side, I have no information because his father had died when he was 3 years old. Now, on my mother's side again, every one of her brothers was a leading and very well-known scholar. Most of them were rabbis. One of them was not a rabbi, but he was a professor of Bible at the Yeshiva University when he came to the United States. My father was a product of the great Lithuanian Yeshiva of Volozhin, and he was also a rabbi of two communities in Lithuania before he came to the United States in 1922.
Your father came then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in Lithuania. I studied in the Yeshiva of Telts, which was in those days one of the outstanding schools in the country. And my brother, I have only one brother, and my mother came to the United States in 1923. And my father was a rabbi in Long Island, in Rockaway, from the day he came till the day of his death in 1954. He also wrote a number of what I would consider to be very significant books dealing in response to literature, and a number of essays, and a book of essays. And that's about all I would say about my family background.
When you were studying in Lithuania, up through what age were you there? When did you come over? When were you born and when did you come over?
Well, shut it up for a minute.
Why, is there a problem?
I'll explain to you.
Okay, if you prefer not to deal with it, okay, why don't you just talk about coming over and about your studies there before you came.
We came in 1923. And I was very young, and I entered the Yeshiva University.
So you had your primary schooling there,
no,
though? Because you said you were in Lithuania studying in some place that was famous.
No, you don't understand. In Europe, we studied only Talmudic studies, biblical.
Not secular.
Studies, not secular.
I see.
When I came here, the United States, I entered the Yeshiva University,
mm-hmm,
which had a high school,
yeah,
a secular high school, and now it also, later on, it opened a college. But I spent very little time in the high school, didn't care for it, so I went to a private prep school. And I made, actually, public school and high school in 18 months. In New York City, you could do it because you take regents. You see, you don't have to. When I passed my regents, I entered Columbia University. I was admitted at Columbia. And I made college in 3 years. Then I went to Teachers College at Columbia, where I received a master's degree, DMA in education. Then I went to Johns Hopkins, where I received another master's degree in Oriental Studies, went to the Oriental Seminary.
Hmm.
Then I went to Lapsa University in Philadelphia, where I took my PhD. I went back later to the Yeshiva, and I received my rabbinical degree. Now, I received my PhD in 1938, and the rabbinical degree in 1941. 40, 41.
Okay, if I can just go back a little bit until we get more into your... Did you want to ask something?
Yeah, I just wanted the name of the school where you got your PhD.
Dropsy University.
Could you spell it, please?
Dropsie. It's for Hebrew, for Hebrew and cognate learning in Philadelphia. It's a very private institution endowed in the beginning of the century. And it offered in my day only one degree, PhD.
I'm curious about a few things in your background before we go beyond this point. One is the Oriental Studies.
Now, the Oriental Studies at Johns Hopkins consisted of, if you call, Hebrew, Biblical Studies in Hebrew, Arabic, Ethiopic, Assyrian, Babylonian, Egyptian, and it was one of the great institutions, graduate schools in the world in its day. For example, I took my MA under William Foxwell Albright, the leading archaeologist of the 20th century. So this my day, when I was there, this was the school that really prepared you for Oriental Studies. They didn't give you any other degree except the MA and the PhD, but it was not a rabbinical institution, it wasn't a theological institution. You see, it was not like, for example, Harvard or Yale, where they have theological seminaries,
mm-hmm, right,
and offer similar studies. I mean, this was the university.
Right, secular studies.
Academic,
right?
Yeah, academic.
Can I ask you some questions about going back? We'll get back to your experiences in studying and your personal advancement in your profession. But I'd like to know a little bit more, if you wouldn't mind, about the home life. I mean, here you were surrounded by so many scholars and so many, you know, your father and your mother's brothers, your uncles, your grandfather, all these people who had contributed so much, who had written so much. What was the atmosphere like in your home? Do you remember before you came, or were you too little?
It was a strictly...
was it an Orthodox home?
Oh, yes, definitely. Of course an Orthodox. Except that my mother was extremely well educated in German, Hebrew, and Yiddish literature. My grandfather, that's her father, sent his sons to yeshivas, the daughters he sent to universities, high schools, universities in Germany. And that's where she got her education. My father was strictly rabbinic, in the rabbinic, in the Orthodox sense.
Mm-hmm. When you made this transition of leaving Lithuania and coming to the United States, what were some of the impressions and some of the, you know, immediate feelings in terms of the changes between living in Europe and coming here? And what was it that made him come over? You know, so many people
didn't leave. Come over was a very simple thing. It was actually at my mother's insistence, because my mother had family here. He also had family in St. Louis, but they were not known to us very well. But my mother's sister, a sister, and a brother lived in New York City. And the reason for my mother's insistence that we can't go to, that he go to the United States, was simply because of opportunities for the children. But here we had the great schools, here it was a free country, and the opportunities would be greater than in staying in Lithuania. I mean, we didn't suffer anti-Semitism to the extent other areas now. That was not the reason. It was purely a concern for the children.
What was the name of the area where you were living, Lithuania? Do you remember?
Yeah, sure. The area was, the capital was Kovno.
Kovno.
And the towns that we came from, which is actually two towns, because one my grandmother lived, my mother's father, my father's mother was Kelum, K-E-L-M, and Kelum plays an extremely important role in that during the Holocaust period.
Hmm.
Incidentally, I just found one of the memoirs about the Holocaust. I found a very interesting incident that happened in a town which is historically known as Lowell. The town of which I came from, where my grandfather and later my father was rabbi, Kroz, K-R-O-Z, but there were neighboring communities, not far from each other.
Were these cities with good-sized Jewish populations,
no,
or they were more towns?
Kelum was a good-sized Jewish population with great schools. But I don't recall the size of the population. Kroz was smaller, but it had an interesting history. The history was that in that city, the city was known because of its outstanding rabbis, a small population, and great scholars serving that community. Incidentally, here in Pittsburgh was one of the rabbis, earlier the rabbis in this city, also came from the same town. But he wasn't a rabbi there. Zibitz. Did you hear of Rabbi Zibitz here?
I don't know if I have. You know, I'm not from Pittsburgh.
What
congregation?
Rabbi Pupka placed him after the town.
Really? From Polisetic?
Shalatoa. He was one of the outstanding scholars, probably.
And originally from the same...
Yeah, the same time.
The same time. It seemed as though there were centers of learning like that, where there were a number of rabbis and Talmudic scholars who shared and discussed things with each other.
Well, in our community, in Kruz, I remember very well, there were many, many Jews who were extremely well-learned in
Talmudic stuff.
Oh, yes. First-rate scholars. Why did he serve as rabbis in the community?
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's why they insisted that the rabbis who come there are renowned already before they were employed.
Were they at all influenced by politically what was happening in Russia, you know, after the revolution? Or they weren't concerned with that?
Well, that's a different story. This is much earlier, see. Father of the revolution didn't affect us, because Lithuania, after the First World War, at the end of the First World War, you see, separated itself from Russia.
Right.
And became an independent, right, independent country, so to speak. So in my day, as I remember, as a very, very young child, we lived under a Lithuanian government. But there was a time when, of course, Lithuania originally belonged to Russia in 1914.
Right.
You see, the Germans took over, mm-hmm, this section of the Balkans. And then the Germans left, and the Lithuanians took over. But it was not a communist state.
Were the Jews able to participate in local government, and they felt fairly free in terms
the
of
Jews,
the community?
The Jews were, on the local level, no. Mm-hmm. The national level, there was a Jewish minister without portfolio in the government.
Hmm.
But that was not for very long.
You started to tell a story about an incident in the Holocaust that had to do with Kroos.
Kellum.
Oh, Kellum. Did you want to tell us?
I cannot tell you that story now. I have it on tape. I have it. I just Xeroxed the story from the book. But it's too horrible, and it's immaterial at the moment. If you want to, sometimes I can give you that story.
Is your brother older than you or younger?
Younger, 3 years younger. Mm-hmm. He lives in Chicago.
When you came over, you said your father took the position as a rabbi in Rockaway, New York.
Yeah.
So that's where you settled immediately.
Yeah.
And what was it like for you and for your brother coming over? I mean, right away you said you went to school. But what was it like in terms of adjusting to the community? And you said your mother
no
had
problem.
Family here.
Absolutely no problem at all. We went to the yeshiva.
Where are you living? Is that Sydney,
no, the
or
yeshiva,
it's really out on Long Island?
The yeshiva now. The yeshiva was in New York City.
Right.
That's the Yeshiva University before it became Yeshiva University.
Mm-hmm.
The university was attached later on. I went to school. I went to Yeshiva prep school at the same time. There wasn't any problem in adjustment.
Your parents were comfortable in the community?
Oh, yes. They were not wealthy, you understand. But they were comfortable, and we had no difficulty.
Was there any kind of feeling that you picked up in terms of becoming American versus Europe? It sounds as though
No.
Your parents were glad to be American.
No.
There wasn't a sense
oh, yes.
of longing
no,
for the past.
No, there was no problem. Not in this kind of a home.
No.
See, there wasn't a need for it.
In other words, the fact that the home is Orthodox and the central focus is the Jewish learning, it doesn't really matter which country to some extent. I mean, it does matter, but
now, you see,
your home life would be consistent wherever you would be living, wouldn't it?
The problem of acculturation
mm-hmm.
is a problem for Jews who are in business and professions.
In terms of influences.
That's right. I mean, they actually live in two worlds, the Jewish world, you say, and in the American world. We didn't have that problem. And we didn't have to run away because we were very comfortable with our Jewishness.
Was there at any point a time as you were going through schooling or university that you became aware that, you know, the Jews around you weren't all living such an insulated Jewish lifestyle, and that people were going in different directions in terms of their practice of Judaism?
Well, yeah, I didn't have to wait to go to school for that. I mean, in every Jewish community, immediately know that there are Jews who are observant and Jews who are not observant, and there are secular Jews and religious Jews. I mean, this is part of the life that you come into, and you acculturate immediately without any problem. You see, it didn't create tension. That didn't create any tension in life.
Because you felt secure in your home life with that as well?
Yes, I mean, we were secure.
Are you and your brother close?
Yes, we are close. He is in Jewish education.
He is.
He just retired. He's been very sick. He built marvelous schools in Chicago. He's a different type. He is completely different. He has talents in one area, which I don't have. Beautiful voice. He was very musically inclined. He was. He had his own little theater, for that matter. And he went even to New York.
What's his name?
Harry.
Harry.
Extremely talented in the field of theater and field of music. And a fine educator. Built three marvelous Salma Schechter schools, which is probably the outstanding school of the day in America, here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen each other frequently because I'm in Pittsburgh now and he's in Chicago.
Okay, you traced for us the schooling from Columbia to teachers to Johns Hopkins, and then to drop through with your PhD into yeshiva with a rabbinical degree. At what point in that development going from place to place, I'm sure at different places, would you like to discuss some of the friends or teachers who especially made an impression on you or who influenced you or with whom you perhaps developed lifelong relationships?
I would say that there were very few teachers that had a very strong impact on me. But there were some. The first was in the yeshiva in my early years. He was the dean of the Teachers Institute of the Yeshiva. His name was Pinchas Churgin, Churgin, and he was the man who founded, later, the Bar Ilan University in Israel. And this man was an unusual personality, the eternal optimist. We could come very close to him, and I had to take from him. At Columbia, I had some great teachers, but they didn't have the influence, I was too young for them. For example, I had John Dewey. Now, a seminar with John Dewey was almost meaningless. It was hard to understand them. And the year after I took a year with him, I went to Teachers College. And there, I took a course with William Kilpatrick, who was the interpreter of Dewey.
Right.
Because Dewey would never, he wasn't understood. And Kilpatrick had an influence on me. I mean, the whole philosophy of democracy and education, which I still live by today, was Dewey's philosophy through Kilpatrick. I had Thorndike at Columbia. The psychologist. I was very close to one of the leading psychologists, the personality man we used to call him, Gardner Murphy. As a matter of fact, he went to manager later on. As a matter of fact, I substituted for Gardner when he was sick, and he was sick quite often, and I would teach for him. He was an extremely interesting person. I would say that Woodward at Columbia was an influence. He also a psychologist, he was the head of the psychology group at that time. At Hopkins, it was Albright. His contributions to archaeology and his fabulous, fabulous knowledge. Just unbelievable. He wrote a book titled "From the Stone Age to Christianity." The first chapter, action introduction, is, I think it's called The Philosophy of History, or, yeah, I think so. He was told me once he was given an honorary doctorate degree by Harvard for that chapter. Yeah. It was so fabulous. When I began to teach at Pitt in the undergraduate, well, I came to Pitt in the graduate school, but they had established for me what they called then a Heinz Foundation lectureship in the undergraduate school, in the history department, in the sub-department, history of religion.
When did you come to Pitt?
I came to Pitt in about 1952. Into Pittsburgh in 51. Next year I joined the graduate faculty and the School of Education and the graduate level. But a few years later, they got a grant from Heinz for 10 years for me to give a course in the religion and culture of the Jews in the undergraduate school in the history department. I used that textbook, that book, From Stone Age to Christianity, as a text in my classes I taught for 10 years. I have to tell you a story about it. I had a very good enrollment in my classes. It was a 3-credit course. For the first number of years, the course was extremely popular. It had 93 students. Everyone Christian tried to get in. And I brought with me a heritage from Johns Hopkins, which Pitt wasn't ready for. One heritage was that I rebelled against giving examinations. I gave some finally, but not a final. The final consisted of a dinner at Student Union for the students, lasting 2 hours. 1 hour devoted to eating and the other hour to discussion. Now, on what basis did I give my grade? Well, the final grade was given on the basis of a term paper, which was never less than 40 pages, and consisting of an analysis of a review, almost an outline, an analysis of Albright's and Stone Age Christianity. My theory was, if they know this book, they deserve an A. one day the head of my department came over, waited from the outside in the classroom, and he said, there are three demons on your neck. What's the matter? You didn't fail anybody. You've got to fail somebody. You've got to give, what is it, five grades? How many grades are there?
The curve from A to F.
No, A, B, C, D, E. And I refused to do it. It was pass or fail. And that's all it was. The second thing which was anathema to be did was that I gave my exams on the honor system.
On the honor system?
On the honor system. This was what actually we did Hopkins. I refused to stand in class watching students. And that was something terrible too. They called me every name under the sun, somebody deals that all. When the 10 years were over, I wouldn't continue in the undergraduate.
You wouldn't?
It was too much for me. I couldn't do it. As a matter of fact, after the first 5 years, I wouldn't accept any freshmen or sophomores. And because somehow I began to notice the level of students that had been coming in. It was extremely low. They found it very difficult reading the first chapter or the second chapter or a whole book, and they would come and say, can you select a few pages here, a few pages there? That wasn't for my temperament.
You wanted students who had had already had the basic knowledge and were ready for
more.
Well,
of course, I mean, those that came in with any cultural background, couldn't understand even worldwide language. Now, the dropsy the man under whom I took my PhD, and he probably one of the truly great influences in my life. His name was Solomon Zeitlin.